I will mention that animal welfare programming on WOOMLP is supported by a companion pet hospital, which is a full-service daytime veterinarian in South Philly, who also provide full grooming and training services. You can learn more at 215-703-PETS. It so happens this morning, I'm happy to say we're joined by Dr. Germano, who happens to be from Companion Pet Hospital, who is going to talk to us about some common ailments and issues that our little furry friends have. How are you this morning?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And it seems like we're getting a good level on you there. Okay. Always when you're in the guinea pig seat there. There's always that moment when we have to determine whether or not you're audible, this being radio, and you are, so that's a good thing. You're a veterinarian.
Yes.
And I think it's really good that we have, that this is not the first time we've had a vet on one of these 2 hours of animal welfare programming. Megan McFarland in the second hour has asked a few questions of some vets she knows. And I think that's a good thing because although a lot of the folks that are hosting these programs are really quite good at what they do and do a tremendous job with animal rescue and know quite a bit about animals, they are nonetheless not... they're not medical professionals, and we don't give medical advice. But it's very good to talk to somebody who has the extensive education and training and experience that it takes to do your job professionally. So again, thanks for coming in. And I had specifically wanted to talk about some of the problems that you see time and time again in your practice. That are things that are actually preventable and or caused by the human. I think that's a good foundational sort of point in question. So what's your primary sort of, no pun intended, pet peeve?
I think, you know, there are several issues that we deal with that, you know, could be quote-unquote preventable, and a lot of them are pretty basic stuff. I think vaccines are a big one. You think of them as kind of default things that people are going to do for their pets, but, you know, for some reason or another, sometimes it doesn't happen, and we do these vaccines, you know, for a reason. These are things that animals can be exposed to that if they're vaccinated against, we can prevent or at least, you know, reduce the clinical signs of these diseases. Vaccines in general are very important, especially in young pets. So younger pets are a lot more susceptible to many of the diseases that we vaccinate against. You know, young cats and kittens that can be exposed to herpes virus, Khaleesi virus, and panleukopenia are definitely aided by getting these vaccines. And dogs are exposed to distemper and something called adenovirus, parainfluenza. Parvovirus is a big one here in the city. We see that quite a bit. And it's rare, and dogs can still get it if they are vaccinated, but it is extremely preventative and extremely important because it can make young dogs very, very ill and even die sometimes. So it's, you know, really important that we try to prevent these things. Rabies, of course, is a legal issue, but if, you know, hopefully not, but if your pet were to be bit or to bite somebody, having a rabies vaccine can save you sheer annoyance of having to quarantine your pet or, you know, worse things that can happen if there is a bite incident. So those things are important. There are some other vaccines that are optional and are very dependent on lifestyle, and we tend to not recommend these unless, you know, we really think that they're warranted. But there are some diseases like leptospirosis, which is kind of a less commonly known disease, but is is definitely out there and can make pets very sick, dogs, but can also make people sick. So this is an important one, you know, that can help protect you as well as your pet.
All right. There, other than sheer, I guess, negligence, is there, I'm not aware of this. I don't know if you've run across this, and this is, I will try and make sure this is the strangest question that I ask you today. Are you aware of any movement among people that is anti-pet vaccination?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we come across. I think, obviously, this comes from a little bit from the human movement of anti-vaccine that we see. And there are definitely some people that are hesitant or resistant to vaccinate their pets as well. And, you know, we try to work with them and discuss with owners the pros and cons of vaccinating. And there are certainly situations in which it's not recommended to vaccinate your pet. And we kind of take those into consideration. Like I said, as lifestyle is, you know, a big one in terms of what is the pet's risk versus what is the, you know, the benefit of the vaccine. And, you know, certainly as pets get older, we tend to, you know, make decisions about whether to continue to vaccinate or not based on the pet's need. But there are definitely people that are hesitant to vaccinate out there. And we, you know, we try to explain to them exactly why we recommend these.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's terrific. And that's very, that's a very reasonable approach. That's fantastic. So, I should have asked this earlier, but do you have a specialization within veterinary medicine personally?
I am not board certified in any specialty, but I do, in addition to seeing dogs and cats, I also see exotic pets. So
okay.
Small mammals, pocket pets like rabbits, guinea pigs, ferrets, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Lizards and birds.
That's very interesting. And I always said, now it happens that I told myself, at least for years when I was growing up, that I wanted to be a veterinarian. And I clearly did not think this through in any way. I did rather well in school, and I took my science classes, and I really did not math up enough. And got into a very competitive university and came in with the understanding I'd be a biology major. And then the first year and a half of that, I realized, oh God, this isn't for me. that I'm just not keeping pace, especially in these massive weeding out classes. They worked. They weeded me out. The massive weeding out classes with the people getting everything correct on the organic chemistry examination, and which just makes your mistakes that much larger. And I ended up with a political science degree, which is fine because now I can't kill. I mean, I can still kill animals, but it would have to be on my own time, not professionally. I have every respect in the world for veterinary medicine, but one of the things that always takes me back and shocks me is that I understand the program might be 1 year longer than a human doctor. Is that roughly accurate?
No, it's pretty similar to human medicine.
But human doctors are providing medical care to one species. And it amazes me that you know, you just ran through, I mean, it's not just all the different mammal species, but then you're getting into birds and lizards. There's an entirely different biology. I mean, there is for many of the mammals too, but I mean, it's incredible to me that one person is capable of doing all of that. Really, it is. I mean, it's remarkable when you consider the challenges with human medicine. With, again, we're one species. You know, lizards are they're not even mammals. So that's very. It's I may later have some questions about that. But I guess one question that I did have and was kind of on our list and was the one, even though it was down on the list, it was the one that raised my eyebrows and made me a little angry, actually, that this is something that you have to deal with or see. But we do have different physiology than even other mammals like dogs and cats. And there was mentioned that there is a background problem with people giving their pets human over-the-counter medicine.
Absolutely. Definitely something that we see. And we kind of live by the saying that if it's poisonous to humans, it's probably going to kill a pet. But if it's safe for humans, it may still kill a pet. But yeah, it's definitely something that we see. I think people, these are their babies, and people get very, very stressed when they are sick and, you know, want to do something they can to help them. But as you said, the biology is very different. Even dogs and cats are very different from each other, let alone how different they are from human beings.
So, I mean, just don't, I guess, unless under the very specific direction of a veterinarian, don't give your pet human medicine.
Absolutely. I mean, if you want to get down to it, legally, it's actually criminal for anybody other than a vet to give human medicine to animals because it's technically off-label use of that medication. If you want to think about it that way, I don't know if anybody's going to be knocking down your door to if you give your pet Tylenol, but you can certainly know that I'm not going to terribly be too happy about it. You know, and I'm sure you won't if you there are unintended consequences of doing that. So unless there are certainly human medicines that are safe for pets, and we do recommend them under certain circumstances, but when in doubt, just get to your vet, you know, or give them a call and before you give them anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, unfortunately, I that might be part of what confuses this in the public mind, is that there are certain, one of our cats, it was suggested, I'm not even going to mention the medication because then people start doing it, but, you know, one of our cats, it was suggested to give a tiny fraction, that's the other thing, their size, that they can only have a tiny, tiny dosage compared to what we do based on body weight and so forth, but, you know, one of our cats was prescribed an over-the-counter human medication in tiny amounts, which could confuse it then in the public mind that it's generally okay, that anything over-the-counter that you take is good for Fluffy, and that, that it's very often tragically not the case. So they're not little people. as no matter if we think of them as little people, they do have different physiology and they're going to react very differently. So, speaking of people and animals and whatnot to give them, I imagine that feeding animals human food is a recurrent problem as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I won't, you know, be the pot calling the kettle black. Sometimes my dog gets some, you know, some frozen green beans and carrots and things like that, or a little bit of, you know, some of my popcorn or something. And it's not, you know, overtly contraindicated to give human food, but there are definitely human foods that are toxic to pets that we don't want to give to them. And I think the bigger issue there is obesity and overweight pets. And I think that feeding table food is a very quick way to have your pet be overweight, and have, you know, some imbalanced nutrition. And so we tend to try to stay away from it as much as possible.
There's also, there are also categories of food that we find delicious, which for dogs and cats can be poisonous.
Yes, absolutely.
Would you like to run through that list for people so they know that, that at least, even, I would say even not even feeding this to your pet necessarily, but just keeping it away from them.
Definitely. And this, I would say for the most part, applies to dogs. Cats, there are cats out there definitely that are interested in eating human food. But if it's toxic to a dog, it's also probably toxic to a cat, because cats tend to be more sensitive than dogs to toxicities. So it kind of applies to both. But in dogs specifically, grapes and raisins can cause renal kidney disease and kidney failure, and we don't actually know why. We haven't figured that out yet, but we know, and it's not even dose dependent, so one grape can definitely make even a big dog pretty sick. There's a certain genetic predisposition. Not all dogs have it, but we don't know which dogs have it, so it's just not worth it to test it out. And so, you know, we definitely recommend keeping those away. I don't know too many cats that eat grapes, but if your cat eats grapes, I would say maybe don't do that. So that's a big one. Chocolate is another big toxicity that we see. Technically, coffee also falls into that category.
So okay.
Usually, that's a trash problem more so than on purpose.
Right. My onions and garlic, I understand, can be harmful. Yeah.
Yeah. Onions and garlic, it tends to be dose dependent, meaning, you know, based on weight. But it's definitely something that we want to stay away from, you know, if you're cooking a big pot of.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
That kind of stuff you don't want to.
Yeah. Your dog or your cat is unlikely to eat a bulb of garlic by itself, but when it's a component of something that smells better, I imagine, to them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. And then we have the general obesity problem with dogs and cats. That's a big question, so I'll just leave that open to you to address.
I think a lot of it stems from the fact that, you know, I think what people see on TV and social media is not always necessarily a representation of what we would call ideal body condition. And so I think people just aren't totally aware of what, you know, what a dog or cat should look like. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's always food is love. And food is a distraction. So people, I think, tend to overfeed their pets, not because they're trying to harm them, but just because, you know, it's how they show affection and interact with their pet. But, you know, they did a very big study in Labrador Retrievers, and even being moderately overweight, especially as a young dog, can, you know, really shorten their life expectancy, sometimes by even, you know, years, one or two years, which we don't get to spend, you know, as much time with our pets as we do with most humans, and you know, we want to keep them as long as we possibly can. And if, you know, diet, which is something that as owners we can control, is a good way to really help, you know, help them stay around as much as possible. And, you know, all that extra fat can secrete inflammatory hormones, and it causes stress on the body. It can also lead to a lot of orthopedic issues like arthritis and joint degeneration. It can predispose them to things, even sometimes like bladder stones. That's even an issue in my exotic species. Bunnies and guinea pigs, if they are overweight, can definitely be predisposed to forming bladder stones, you know, which requires surgery to fix.
Yeah.
So not something that we want to do if we don't have to.
No, certainly not. I can't even imagine. There's a skill set in doing surgery on a guinea pig that requires, I think, like model shipbuilders would apply some of those same techniques. Jeez. That has to be one of the most common problems. And I have to say, we have five cats. Three of them are from the same litter from our alleyway. Before we were able to trap neuter release in our alleyway, before we could catch one female cat, she had a couple of litters, and we ended up with her cats. And three of them are from the same litter, and one of them, I think the boy of those three seems to be right on target weight. Just seems like he looks like the cat on the... his silhouette is the silhouette of the healthy cat on the cat poster. And the one of the two sisters is barely... She flirts with being slightly underweight, and she just seems to have a very high metabolism and maybe just doesn't eat as much. And then the third sister from that, out of the same litter, she's a big gal. And we don't really necessarily free feed the cats. We feed them at the same time. For the most part, they eat most of their food when it's presented. But we think two things are going on, one of which is that she appears to go back for somebody else's plate. But also, I mean, I think she has a genetic disposition to being larger. We suspect she may even have a different father, which I think is a possibility.
Yep.
I think that there might be a lot of people in this, especially cat owners, because cats It's just but both the way they eat and the fact that people with cats tend to have more than one. What suggestions might you make for the portly cat in a household where the other cats are in the healthy weight range?
Cats are definitely one of the more difficult species to work with weight for all those reasons that you mentioned, and because cats are just, you know,
it's hard to take them out for a run too. I mean, there's, you know, we try and there are a few things we do to play with it. She likes the laser, the little, you know, chasing the little laser dot, but she's not fetching anything. She observes it go by, you know. Not really a big climber. You know, there's a limited amount of things that we can get to do to get her to exercise. So, and we know this isn't healthy, and but there's just I don't know. I mean, we can try and monitor her her food intake more and pull her away from a plate before she can go back for seconds, which is a little hard sometimes. But I mean, yeah, I don't know. It seems to be difficult to say what. I don't think we're overfeeding them, but you know, but yeah. So there's a whole range of problems that come with obesity. You mentioned arthritis and joint problems that animals can have. I have you seen the products advertised on TV? I haven't seen a commercial lately. But it just makes me mad. It makes me shake my fist at the TV that they're allowed to advertise this. But there's a homeopathic pet joint spray, which I'm sure is probably water. You know, and the old James Randi joke that the homeopathic medicine, you know, if you don't take any at all, you'll overdose. But just, have you seen this product?
I haven't. I have seen many interesting products that, you know, over the years that owners have brought in that they have found, you know, through one source or another. I have not seen this spray that you're talking about. Okay. I would be skeptical, but, you know, obviously open to seeing at least what's in it.
Right. There's nothing in it.
Well, then I think
it's water. I mean, it's water where the water touched other water that touched other water, which at one point touched something which makes your joints hurt. Is I think how that works.
I would say, you know, we try to stick as much to, you know, evidence-based medicine as we possibly can, and there are a lot of great products out there that have scientific studies behind them and testing and things that have, you know, proven results that we know are helpful and that we know are going to benefit, you know, the joints or whatever other, you know, type of supplement we're talking about. And so we try to tend to stick to those more so, not to say that there aren't some homeopathic things, you know, that people have had success with, and alternative, you know, therapies are definitely, you know, acupuncture and laser therapy and physical therapy are all really great adjuncts to, you know, to treating arthritis or joint disease. But in terms of supplements and things like that, we try to stay with the ones that have some scientific evidence behind them that have been tested, you know, even in the human supplement market.
Right.
Things aren't terribly well regulated, and, you know, you don't always know what you're getting when you purchase a product like that. So we try to stick to those ones that we know for sure are going to be beneficial.
Yeah, I guess it's good to stick to something that has an active ingredient.
Yeah.
But it's just the way I've seen these, the next time you're in a pet store, I mean, the major pet chains have on the shelf, you know, these sprays, and part of the advertising hook is they have no side effects. And I've been thinking, well, I should think not. It's, you know, unless rain has a side effect, you know, that I'm not aware of. But they show the pets limping around on the TV commercial. They get sprayed with the spray, and then a month later, the owner's running them around and having them chase a frisbee. And I'm thinking, well, at this point, you're just torturing your pet. And the worst part to me is that there isn't even a There isn't even a placebo effect because the animals are completely ignorant of placebo effects. They don't know that they've been given any medicine. So they're not even getting that benefit in any way. And I just, that one just drives me up a wall. It's like you can't even, you can't give a placebo to a dog. So I mean, maybe a very advanced dog. I don't know. But, running down the list, there's the food issues. How about letting your animals out, typically a cat out in the city. Is this something that you have a position on from a medical perspective?
That's a hard one, especially in the city here, and I think, you know, no matter what I say, there will be people who disagree and people who agree. You know, in general, especially for cats, we prefer for them to be inside if possible because they, you know, we have a lot more control over their health that way.
Sure.
You know, they're not exposed to, you know, ectoparasites like fleas and ticks and mosquitoes. And you talk about controlling diet, you're able to know exactly what they're eating instead of, you know, if they're getting into things, especially things that could be toxic to them that are out, you know, out in the world. And then diseases, feline leukemia and feline AIDS are pretty prevalent in the city. We have a pretty big stray population, and so if they're out associating with other kitties that are not, you know, protected, there is always that risk. Now, I know there are those cats that are just cannot, you know, be inside all the time. They are absolutely miserable and will drive you absolutely nuts, you know, pawing at the door and crying and marking and things like that. So there are those cats that are a lot happier, you know, to be out. And if they are, we definitely, there's a lot of preventative measures that we recommend for those guys. You know, going back to vaccines, there is a leukemia vaccine that we would recommend for those pets, and definitely, you know, topical flea and tick and heartworm preventative. Not a lot of people know cats can get heartworm. It's rare, but it can happen. Not easy to test for, and can cause sudden death in cats. So preventatives for those kinds of things are definitely important. There is also the rare cat that just likes to hang out in the yard. They don't necessarily go roaming around and having adventures during the day, but they like to sit outside and watch the animals. You know, we still definitely recommend preventatives for those guys. I have a couple of patients that walk on a leash, they, you know, it's a great way to get exercise for them. And, you know, as long as they're protected, there are some cats whose lifestyle that just fits for. We would, you know, love for them to be inside. And if they have to go outside, then we want to make sure that we keep them protected against the things that they're getting exposed to.
I think it's interesting. We haven't really experimented much with trying to put a leash on any of our cats. I know a few of them would be absolutely terrified, and a couple of them might go for it. But unfortunately, the hefty one, I think, would not go for it, which is a shame because that walk would be positive. There are you mentioned heartworm. There are intestinal worms that cats and dogs can frequently get as well. I mean, I know whenever our cats we took out of the alley, I mean, I think every single one of them needed to be dewormed. So that's, I guess, something to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well, are there. We had mentioned that there are some diseases that are rare because we do have different physiology, but there are some diseases which can be transmitted animal to human. Do you see much of anything ever in the other direction of communicable diseases that are transmitted from human to animal? Is that extremely rare? Or?
That's pretty uncommon, you know, luckily. There are a few things that can go back and forth, but, you know, us giving things to pets is pretty uncommon. Usually they would have to be, you know, some pretty immune compromised, you know, either the human or the animal or both, you know, to cause that to happen. I actually would say I see that probably more in exotic species than I do in, you know, in dogs and cats. Like ferrets can are somewhat susceptible to some of the viruses and colds that we can get, surprisingly. But there's not too many things that, you know, that we can give pets. We have our skin bacteria, you know, is a little bit different. And a lot of the things that can affect us don't necessarily affect our pets.
What I would say that certainly more than 20 years ago, the ferret is a more common pet than it was. Or I 30 years ago, it was extraordinarily exotic, I think. What are the vaccination requirements for ferrets, if any? Is there a set of laws?
There are definitely. Okay. Ferrets are pretty much one of the very few exotic species that have vaccination requirements.
Oh.
Not too many other things. There are some things for birds and specifically chickens and things like that, but not too many other exotics get vaccinated. Ferrets fall under kind of similar rules as cats. They are usually, for most states, encompassed by the rabies laws for the state, because they can technically carry rabies. And the there is a ferret distemper, is a disease. It's similar to canine distemper. But the vaccination for that is a little iffy at the moment, given we're having a hard time with supply of the ferret distemper vaccine. And that's also kind of a risk factor decision. But technically, ferrets are supposed to be vaccinated by rabies for rabies. I'm pretty sure in almost all states.
Okay, and there's is it true? I vaguely recall that hedgehogs are illegal in Pennsylvania. Is that true?
Yes, hedgehogs are technically illegal in Pennsylvania.
All right, because they're considered an invasive species, I guess?
It's actually due to a very old rule or law concerning a fairly contagious disease. Back when they were mostly imported, there was a concern that they could carry some stuff that could affect cattle and humans and things like that, but that risk is, I would say, extremely low at this point. So the law is kind of based on that.
Okay, I had no idea. I was running on an assumption without looking anything up that it was because it was assumed that they would breed and get out and displace some native species like the reticulated Pennsylvania chipmunk or something like that, and so there was a there'd be a ban on them for that reason. I had no idea that it was related to any disease fears. And I guess keeping in that line, because from what I think I've heard every minute of the animal welfare programming on this station thus far, and I don't think that anybody has yet touched on birds in any sense. What are the basic for people with any kind of bird? And there's a wide range of both price entry points and life length and so forth.
Absolutely.
With birds. But what are the things that someone who is a bird owner should be doing for health maintenance?
There's a lot of things. I think probably for birds, one of the biggest things is dietary as well.
Okay.
A lot of stuff with exotic medicine comes down to what we call husbandry, which is basically kind of the care and keeping of the pet, their environment, their diet. And a lot of birds are on diets that are not necessarily healthy for them. And, just because they sell it in a store doesn't necessarily mean it's safe or healthy for your pet. That goes for any species. I see a lot of birds that are on very high nut and seed diets. And for most birds, that's not usually the best way to go. They are definitely one of the more predisposed to atherosclerosis. It's not something we tend to see in our kind of dogs and cats and a lot of other exotics, but birds, much like humans, can get a lot of fat accumulation around their organs and in their arteries. That can cause a lot of problems, and they're on some pretty high fat diets, and we usually recommend trying to get them on a highly pelleted diet because they're usually more well-rounded. They're supplemented with nutrients, and they're a lot less fatty than kind of some of the seed and nut diets that are out there. And I would say that's one of the big issues that I see with birds.
And that's more of a, that's kind of more of an organ obesity that you might not see the bird getting physically larger.
Yeah, and it can be, it's hard to tell. You know, it's definitely hard to tell, especially if you don't know what you're looking for, if your bird is overweight.
Right, right. And I mean, most people would probably have no concept of what that would look like to begin with. So, I mean, that, I think that's very, I think that's interesting because it's in there. A decent number of people have birds. I think this is the first time that any such question has been asked on the station. So, we should keep in mind the fuller range of pets out there. And I see, there's a fair number of, guinea pig and rabbit ownership and so forth and rodents. What are the, first off, when people have a sick gerbil or a sick hamster, they have short lifespans. And typically they're owned by a child.
Not always.
Okay. No, I make no judgments here at all. I had some gerbils when I was young. Are people pretty good about bringing them in if they're not doing well?
I think this comes down to a lot of, you know, one of the bigger issues with exotic medicine. You know, we're trying to get more cats in the door, and I think exotics are going to be kind of the next subject of, you know, trying to get them in for preventative medicine as opposed to, you know, once they get sick. And I'm sure for every one gerbil or hamster that I see, there are thousands that I am not seeing.
Sure.
But there are definitely people that are, you know, as committed to them as some people are to their, you know, their dogs and their cats. I definitely see them. I would say sometimes you'd be totally surprised. There are definitely a lot of younger owners that I see for exotic pets, but sometimes they are some of the best educated and the best prepared owners that I see.
That's fantastic.
You know, really invested and involved in their pet. But people definitely do bring them in. You know, like you said, their lifespans are short, and sometimes we kind of consider that in terms of, you know, what is worth it to do and what is not, and take that into consideration. But there are some people that are, you know, so committed they're going to do whatever it is that they can, you know, to help them. And we try to do as much as we can. Obviously, in little small creatures, we're a little bit limited. But there are definitely, you know, things that can help them if they are not feeling well.
So you parenthetically you just mentioned that there's a movement to get the exotics in more, and that this is kind of trailing off of the movement to get more cats in to see the vet. Has there been? I'm pretty new to cat ownership. Has there been traditionally a reticence on the part of cat owners to have them see a vet?
I would say statistically, less cats come to the vet than dogs, definitely. And I think that's for a variety of reasons. I think one, in general, cats tend to be much more easily stressed out, and people, you know, don't want to bring them in to help reduce, you know, their stress. And you know, we work really hard to try to reduce that in cats as much as possible. And there are, you know, a lot of what we call fear-free methods to trying to make that a much more pleasant experience for them. Getting them in the carrier can be difficult for some owners at home. And I think some, you know, I think there's just a little bit of a difference of opinion about cats, but I think slowly and surely we're trying to change that. But you'd be surprised how many people think cats don't need to go to the vet.
Right. because they're just magical creatures.
Yes,
who never get
sick.
Right. So I, uh, What are some, when somebody's taking, we have, again, we have five cats, so there's a pretty wide range of their behavior if we want to get them in a carrier. A couple of them, if we bring out a carrier and open it, well, the two boys, if we bring out the carrier and open it, the boys will just get into the carrier because they're curious about the carrier, and then before they know it, the doors close. And it's far easier than anything Wile E. Coyote ever did with the Roadrunner. We don't even need to put a treat in there. You just open the carrier and it's an empty. They like a box and they get into it and then the door shut and you're on the way to the vet, whether you like it or not. What preparing for the owner to prepare the cat more or less for presentation to you when it's checkup time. What are some hints or tips that you might have for getting the cat to the vet?
A carrier is a big, big thing. Making sure, one, the type of carrier that you have can even make a really big difference. Mm. We prefer kind of the plastic molded carriers, especially one where the top can be taken off pretty easily, because once they get to the vet, it's a lot less stressful to just nicely lift the lid off instead of having to kind of squeeze them out the door, or pull them out. Any reduction in stress is great. And leaving your carrier out all the time can make a huge difference.
Right.
Putting a little blanket in there, feeding them treats in there, having it be a place that they can go to feel safe and to hang out. Because like you said, lots of cats like boxes and hiding places and things. So taking the door off and just leaving it out so that it's not a brand new thing when you bring it out and so they don't associate it with going to the vet all the time can really help reduce that. There are a lot of great products, stress relieving products out there for kitties that you can apply to the crate and to spray and put on towels and things like that, some of which we use, in the hospital as well. That can really help, reduce the stress as much as possible. It starts at home, we say that, and if we can reduce the stress before they come in, they have they're much more tolerant of us doing our thing. But definitely the carrier can make a huge difference in a cat's experience at the vet.
So what do you do for stress reduction when a cat is coming in? Do you have a martini or something? So I imagine on your end, I don't know. I'm always amazed by the handling of just how careful you have to be to handle a cat who really doesn't want to be at the vet and get blood drawn or what have you at the time. I can imagine that's you must. I don't know if you folks do meditation or some deep yoga before coming into work or what it is that you do. Herbal teas. Chant mantras, but there's another we haven't going a little further into the maybe into the exotics, folks with snakes and lizards, are they pretty good, or are they generally pretty knowledgeable and pretty good about bringing their animals in for checkups, or is that some? Is there an, if you have a boa constrictor, is there an annual checkup suggested, or I'm not sure how this works.
I would say definitely our reptile owners are usually really, really well informed and really well educated in their pets, and because they need some pretty specific care. Same kind of applies as does to the other pets. I do see them, and those owners are usually really invested and involved, and if they've done all the things that they think they could do at home, and then they're out of ideas, they usually bring them into me. And I'm sure for every snake I see, there are hundreds of snakes at home that I'm not seeing. But
that's a terrifying sentence.
But
I think that's a rule for infestations, isn't it? For everyone you see, there are hundreds that you're not seeing.
snakes are actually pretty amazing, you know, and wonderful creatures, and they can, it's certain species, you know, accepted, but they, you know, they can be just as interactive as a dog or cat, and but yeah, their owners definitely tend to be really, really well informed, you know, just because they require quite a bit of upkeep, and as any pet requires a lot of investment, but sure. I would say definitely my reptile owners are really know what they're doing for the most part.
It seems like a community that's people are into it or into it. It's
exactly.
I make there are a few other groups of people out there, like model train enthusiasts and some other groups of people where I'm just I don't know anything about what they do and I'm not interested, but I love that those people exist and that they know what they what they're doing and that they're interested. I always love to see communities of people who know something about what it is they do, regardless of what it is or my interest in it. Do you ever see folks coming in with a species that you know not to be here legally?
Yeah, that happens.
All right. And I mean, if somebody has an animal that is not strictly legal to own or in the state or the country, is that something that they? I mean, the priority is still to take the animal to the vet if the animal needs veterinary care.
Absolutely,
I mean,
and my concern is just, you know, to take care of that pet and you know, make them as healthy as possible. There's a little what happens at the vet stays at the vet kind of
right. So there's a. I mean, is there a patient sort of a client confidentiality? The set of laws as there is for human medicine?
There isn't necessarily a confidentiality law. There is, you know, the veterinary patient-client relationship is legally described, but there are no required reporting laws for most of those species.
Okay.
You know, with the exception of, you know, certainly venomous species and things like that, or
right.
or pets that could be, you know, potentially extremely dangerous. You know, it's not great, and I'm probably going to advise that you find alternate home for that pet, but you know, there are no real required reporting laws for most of those species unless they're, you know, sick with certain diseases.
Right.
So, you know, we tend to kind of just, you know, do our best to take care of them and kind of go from there.
All right. And let me ask you this too, and you may get this question sometime. For any younger people out there who are perhaps people who are returning to school or what have you and are interested in a career in veterinary medicine, what might be some of your pieces of advice for them?
Pieces of advice. It's definitely a job that, you know, has its challenges. It's hard to find somebody that's going to say, I don't love animals. You know,
right.
That's a pretty common thing that, you know, that people love dogs and cats, but, and I definitely do my fair share of snuggling with puppies and kittens. Mm-hmm. And we call it our serotonin tax when they come in. And, you know, it's one of my favorite parts of the job, but it's definitely a job that also, you know, requires a lot of, you know, emotional intake and so just because, you know, loving dogs and cats can sometimes make it more difficult. And so it's something that you definitely want to seriously think about. Definitely something I did before I decided to go to veterinary school was volunteering at various animal hospitals and shelters and the zoo and things like that, just to kind of get a feel of, you know, what day-to-day veterinary medicine is like. And it's an unbelievably rewarding career. And, you know, I can't imagine myself doing anything else, but it's not for everybody.
Right.
And there can definitely be some sad times as well. And not everybody is necessarily prepared or, you know, or suited for that, but volunteering is a great way to kind of test it out and see what it's like, you know, before committing to going to, you know, many years of school and,
sure.
you know, and loans and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's quite the commitment. I mean, that's part of the reason I didn't do it. I probably needed to math up more. But are there still only, what is it, less than 30 vet schools in the United States? Is something like that?
There are definitely a lot fewer than medical schools. They're building a few new ones, actually.
There are. That was my next question. Because I just always wondered if the United States was producing the number of vets that we needed to. I mean, given the growth in the American population, and it seemed like we were stuck at about 26 vet schools in the country there for a while. And one of them was West Point, which still is West Point, I think, which was originally for the horses, for Army horses. And not everybody is getting into West Point, so that kind of took one off the list. Did you happen to go to Penn?
I did.
Okay, because that's, I don't think, I think that's something, growing up in Philadelphia, as I did, and as a lot of the listeners did, I don't think people necessarily understand how rare it is to have a veterinary school in the city. I think that people sort of normalize that somewhat because there's Penn Vet, but the average American city does not have a veterinary school. that's a rarity. And I don't think that people necessarily, understand that. And then there are also, a person doesn't necessarily have to be, just as in human medicine, you know, you can be a doctor, but there are other medical professionals, there's nursing and so forth, and there are, could you let people know about what the requirements are to be a veterinary technician or various other jobs that you may have in a practice like yours, where a person could still be involved and be a professional without that same level of multiple year commitment and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely are always in need of veterinary technicians or veterinary nurses. There isn't a standardization quite yet across the board for veterinary nursing. You can be a veterinary nurse in most states without having a certification, but there are definitely a lot of great veterinary nursing programs out there. There's kind of on-the-job learning versus, you know, going to school. And I have met excellent, excellent nurses that have done both. And so that's a little bit kind of up to you. I think that eventually there may be some standardization, just like there is in human medicine, but as of right now, there's not. The veterinary technicians get to do a lot of really, really great stuff, and you can do even certifications within veterinary nursing. So you can do a specialty, and get certified in critical care and emergency medicine, anesthesia. There are a lot of specializations that you can go back and do, just kind of like a nurse practitioner would do, or a nurse anesthetist. You can do those similar things in veterinary medicine. So there's a lot of, you know, opportunity for job satisfaction and promotion and things like that as well.
Yeah, I think people sometimes forget that those are options. And I mean, if I were an anesthesiologist, I would find it so much more interesting to be an anesthesiologist at a veterinary clinic than the same folks getting their whatever surgeries over and over again, probably cosmetic. That's great. And we just have a few minutes left. Let me just ask you the open-ended question here. Just something that I haven't touched on because I'm not on the inside and perhaps maybe shouldn't have been the person asking the questions, but what are any things that you as a vet would like to just say to people in general that's something that I didn't cover at all?
Oh, what an opportunity.
Yes. Yeah, you could tell. This is also, you could actually, a bunch of folks are listening, maybe folks back at the workplace, if you want to complain about how, you know, when your name on the yogurt means that it's yours or what have you, here's your big chance.
I would say probably the first thing is we love snacks. So, you know, if you like your veterinarian and you like your veterinary nurses, snacks are always a great option.
something sugary to keep the keep you going. Mm-hmm. There, short-term energy.
Yeah, and okay. I would have to say probably the other thing is remember that your veterinarian and your veterinary nurses and your receptionist that work at your practice, you know, love your pet almost as much as you do, or as close to, you know, to loving them as you could, and that we're humans too, and we're, you know, working hard to try to take care of your pets. So, you know, sometimes giving us the benefit of the doubt, you know, can go a really, really long way. You know, we always want to do what's best for your pet. And, you know, we have pets of our own. And so we understand, you know, what it's like to make those decisions and, to be dealing with a sick pet. You know, and we're always going to, you know, try to recommend to you the best possible, you know, options, for your pet. And we have your pet's best interest at heart, you know, when we're making those recommendations.
All right. That's great. I didn't ask you, who do you have at home, animal wise?
I have a little bit of a zoo. I have an Australian Shepherd Border Collie mix named Raven. Mm. I have two kitties, Montague and Remedios, and I have a bearded dragon named Ruder.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes I joke I also have a husband.
Okay. All right. Well, yes. I mean, the most dangerous game of all, humans. Are the cats kept away from the bearded dragon, or are they curious? Is there a security system you have around the enclosure, or what?
He spends most of the day in his tank, and the tank has like a locking lid, so they can't get in there. I think when I initially got him, they were a little bit more interested. Now they don't really care. My female cat likes to sleep on top of the tank, I think because it's warm.
It's warm. Yeah.
Yeah. Not too interested when I take him out and let him kind of roam around. My male cat doesn't seem to be really interested at all.
Okay.
I think my female cat would love to play with him, but I just, you know, keep them separate.
Right.
You know?
When you say play with, do you think that would actually be play, or do you think that would be an attempt for a meal? Or?
I think it might be an attempt for her to pick him up and take him away.
Okay.
I don't think she would try to eat him, but she might try
just move him around like a toy. Okay.
Exactly.
I sometimes wonder too. I mean, cats are supposed to be warm-blooded mammals, but sometimes they behave like reptiles. They just lay on something warm, and sometimes half the time I think that some of them are laying on me because I'm warm.
Definitely.
You know, it's like, I know why you're here. This is an affection. All right. Well, Dr. Germano, thank you so much for, did I get your name right that
you
time?
Did.
I did. Look at that. Right. Third time. Thank you so much. And I'll remind people at home, that, Companion Pet Hospital is a proud supporter of WOOM LP 92.9 FM Philadelphia. Companion Pets is a full-service daytime vet serving South Philadelphia who also offer grooming and training services. Learn more at 215-703-PETS. Thank you so much. If people can hold on for just a sec here, I am going to try and get you listening to Megan McFarland submitted this week's program of Mums and Mutts, which is upcoming in just a couple of minutes. And a reminder that you are listening to WOOM LP 92.9 FM Philadelphia.